The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I am back at the Blue Bovine Private Wine Club here at Union Station with their newest head sommelier and advanced sommelier diploma and winner of one of the most recent 2025 CAPS Cup Tasting Challenges, Jeffrey Rowell. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you very much for having me, Matt.
A lot to get into here. And you know what? Before we started, you actually were saying you help train people in terms of how they speak. The one thing we do all the time, and I do it, we all do it, I'm in radio, I still do it, is the or the long uhs. And we were just getting started. You were saying you were teaching people ways to try to avoid that. Is that for when you're doing staff training? Is that for at any of the restaurants you've worked in either now or in the past?
That's just everything. Everything that we do, especially in this industry, involves talking. It involves being in front of people, speaking with purpose. It's a very distinct thing. It's a very important thing. Confidence sells. As a trained actor, that's what I did for 12 years of my life before this, I learned to understand that speaking is about finding the next sound. It's about continuing. It's about just showing confidence. The is the first thing. The it denotes a lack of confidence at the end of the day. So we eliminate that. We look a bit more thoughtful, and then we continue.
I imagine it is harder to sell someone a really nice bottle of Second Growth Bordeaux with seven uhs leading up to it, even if it's just subliminal, you know.
Sure.
And it's that confidence. Okay.
Chateau Montrose.
So now we have to go in a completely different area than all the questions that I have. Where did you study? Where did you study theater? I'm much older than you. My background is actually a double major in theater and history in university. I was a drama kid in high school and university.
Yeah, for sure. So I went to one of the first regional arts programs in Ontario. I was at St. Elizabeth in Thornhill. Then I went to university for it as well, York University, one of the most prestigious programs, I would say, in this country.
It's going to happen.
The arts program there, the conservatory that they do at York University, competes with the best of the master level programs in the U.S. So that was where I did my training. I was one of 16 people doing that for 4 years, continued on for a fifth year, but stayed in theater for a small period of time. Realized there wasn't really any money in it, which I'm sure you realized as well after your double major.
Yes.
So we do something else.
The interesting thing is people are always shocked when I tell people, when I tell anyone, if you want to be in sports radio, take an improv course.
Sure.
It'll teach you how to listen. It'll teach you better how to react, be quick on your feet. And I think it's funny. I was the only guy in theater with a football jersey on and my favorite quarterback, my favorite team. It's just not a usual thing. The football guys and usually in theater. And yet theater has helped me to this day doing a sports talk radio show. I imagine the theater helps you not only on the floor, but when it came to doing the advanced CMS, when it came to doing the different wine competitions as well. Just the theater background must have probably helped you in ways that at the time you had no idea it was going to benefit you years down the road.
100%. I mean, improv is a great reference point. What we do on the floor, it's all performative, not in a bad way, but we're showing ourselves in a different way. We're responding to situations, and the first thing improv teaches you is to be in the moment, to respond very, very fast, but with purpose. It's the yes and. The second you start saying no and shutting things down, you get really stuck, you get really jaded, you get really miserable, and you stop doing things well. But when you say, I'm going to take this information and digest it and do something with it, absolutely, it's a great thing to have. For as far as going into the examination side of being a sommelier, it helps with the service aspect for sure. Everything else is a little bit more, let's say, pejorative.
There must have been times during your career where, you know, you've suggested a wine, then they said, no, I hate that wine. And then having the yes and the improv, like, yeah, I don't like that wine either. Foolish of me. Like, there's certainly must have been times it must help just put a situation at ease.
Yeah, well, I mean, 100%. We all sell things that we don't care about. Mm-hmm. you know, and that is one of the most important lessons for every young sommelier out there. Every person who wants to break into any part of sales is, it doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what you like. Your job is to sell. When somebody says, oh, I really like this thing, well, that's great. I'm going to take that and say, I'm going to find you the best version of this thing. Not, oh, that's dumb and gross and you should be ashamed of yourself. You should be drinking this instead. I mean, that's not the job. The job is, you like this? Great. I have the best version of this.
So I'm ordering, now we're doing role play. This is not at all what I expected this interview to be. I have now decided to order, you know, seafood tower and just going to have lots of oysters. But I need the biggest Malbec to go with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sounds fantastic. And I'm so happy you're going to drink that. Maybe you can put some ice in it as well. I don't have to drink it. Put a straw in the glass. It doesn't matter to me.
In the back of your mind, like, what are you doing?
But yeah. But and at the front, it's, yeah, 100%. Great. Maybe I can get you onto Catena Zapata's.
Sure.
Top Argentaria bottling. It's going to be delicious. It absolutely enhances every moment of that oyster. The brackishness, the fishiness. Perfect, perfect combination.
I love, by the way, the last 45 seconds to a minute has not only been wine nerdy, but drama nerdy as well. All right, let's go back to wine for a second. I want to first start actually with the advanced sommelier for the quartermaster, which is incredibly difficult to pass. It is such a challenge, and it takes up so much of your life. What are the last couple months like before for you, for the prep, for the final exam?
So, yeah, to your point, and to put a little context on that, I was one of two Canadians to pass this year. There were, I want to say, a dozen of us down there from Canada, mostly in Ontario, but it was just two of us, myself and Koki Ponkivar, who passed this year.
Guest on the pod.
Okay, great. Yeah. She's a really, really smart girl. She's very, very busy, but she's a great educator. She's doing a lot, for sure. She's very, very public about what she's doing. But it's not the last 2 months that are most important. It's creating a curriculum for yourself that's usually around 20 to 40 weeks. So going into it, you have to, one, understand yourself and the way that you study, and two, build something that makes sense. So yeah, 30 weeks as a good midpoint, you go, okay, I'm going to study 1 week this, 1 week this, 1 week this, 1 week this, and not punish yourself for not studying, but just get into the rhythm of it. So starting with an hour every day, okay, I'm going back into a region, let's say Bordeaux, I'm looking at the growths, I'm looking at the main grapes, I'm looking at production levels, I'm asking questions that hopefully I haven't asked before, as well as reviewing everything that's there, and then jumping to the next, not getting stuck, you know, just constantly moving region to region to region, but also throwing in spirits, sake, cocktails, throwing in beer, throwing in every other part of production, studying viticulture and viniculture at the same time, asking yourself questions about what the difference between American and French oak is, but also Slovenian, Hungarian, all the different types of oak, what different coopers are doing, just kind of constantly moving, but trying to uncover, pick up as many stones as possible and look what's underneath. So I actually slowed down in the last couple weeks before the exam, because I said, if I'm still cramming information into my head at this point, something hasn't stuck.
Right. You're doomed if it's...
Yeah, 100%. You trust what you've learned. You trust the information that you have. And it's just a little bit of review at that point. So the last 2 months, 6 weeks of it is major, major cramming and going, okay, I've neglected this region, I've neglected this area, this part is brand new to me, whatever. Looking at maps, looking at currents, looking at wine law and everything else. And then the last 2 weeks, I did myself a favor and I just relaxed about it. I said, listen, I've done all the studying that I can. I'm not putting anything new in my brain right now. A little bit of review, a couple flashcards and whatever. But at this point, slow down, relax, trust the training, and go into it.
Can you take people from what you remember, what the questions are, what they asked you with service? I don't know if they ever revealed what wines you had to taste, but at the very least, was it, these are five Pinot from different parts of the world? Like, what do you remember? Because I think people are always curious. They've seen all the movies and just curious about what actually goes on the theory, on the service, and on the tasting.
I think a lot of people struggle with the idea of blind tasting because it feels like if everything's possible, how are you ever going to get to what the wine is? But the reality is there's some 30 styles that we actually have to use as reference points. A lot of them are similar, don't get it wrong, but the wines that they want to put in front of you are very emblematic of what they are, where they're from, and the grape that's behind it. They're not trying to trick you. They want examples that are really, really clear. So, you know, as an example, Burgundian Pinot Noir, very, very testable. California Pinot Noir, very, very testable. And there's kind of a world of difference between those two things. But as long as you can pick up Pinot Noir, then you're in a great place to kind of figure out where it's from. And that's where theory comes in hand. You go, okay, is this a warm climate or a cool climate? Is there oak use? What kind of oak is being used? The theory part is the most important. The last 10% is deciding what it is. But you have to go through the whole thing of, this is what it looks like, this is what it tastes like, this is what it smells like. To me, the most important thing that I relied on was structure. I said, if it's high acid, low alcohol, that's a cool climate. So that already eliminates a whole bunch of places in the world, and we can hone in on where that thing's coming from. I got 4 of the 6 grapes that were presented to me correct. So I know that all of the reds that I had tasted were right. I had a Pinot Noir, I had a Bordeaux blend, and I had an Amarone. The whites, I struggled a little bit more with. I got one of them correct, but structure told me a lot, and my description of structure did enough to get me past that hurdle at the end of the day. But neutral whites are every sommelier's bane when it comes to blind tasting.
By the way, it's very nice of you. You poured a white for us to sip on for this interview, and then you know, oh, what is it? And you asked, well, you tell me. Thank you for picking a Loire, for picking Sancerre, which is certainly much easier to figure out than if you did some Pinot Blanc from Alsace, or even worse, some of the less aromatic whites from Portugal or Spain.
Or let's say a Pinot Grigio from Friuli.
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't smell or taste like anything, does it?
That's, by the way, it's so mean. That's so mean when they throw stuff like that on it.
But it's on purpose, right? It's such a recognizable style. More so, it's a style that everybody knows and so many people ask for consistently in the restaurant space. So, of course, we have to recognize it. As sommeliers, we get tied into the idea of blind tasting for defining what the wine is. But it's also super important to recognize quality. Qualitative blind tasting is maybe more important and less focused on along the way. But jumping from advanced to mastery, to the master sommelier level, I would say has a lot more to do with that, because now you jump from a passing grade of 60% to 75%. And the big difference is, if you're tasting Sangiovese and you say, this is the best Sangiovese I've ever tasted, that's easy to walk into Brunello. But as soon as the quality starts to drop, can you keep it in that area? Or does it go to Vino Nobile? Or does it go to Chianti Classico? And it truly has to do with the quality of the wine at hand and recognizing, you know, which one's the most prestigious? Why is it the most prestigious? Which one's the most expensive? And how do you recognize that in a glass?
What advice would you give to someone who's at a nice restaurant and they're ordering wine by the glass? Let's say a Chianti. What are markers they should look for that they know, okay, I've spent $23 for this glass of wine, but at the very least it tastes good. Like you were talking before about looking for quality. What are some just general markers you look for that you can tell, okay, this is a good glass of wine. It might not be the greatest ever, but this is a good glass of wine and it's worth my time as I'm sitting at the bar.
I mean, first and foremost, do I like it? Does it taste good? We've had a lot of glasses of wine in our lives that simply didn't taste good. And I'm not talking about matters of taste specifically. Not does it taste good to me, but does it taste good in general? Does it have texture? Does it have weight? Does it have something that you can grasp onto and say, oh, I understand why somebody would really enjoy this. But personally, I'm always going to examine structure in my glass. Does it have acid, tannin, alcohol, body? You know, what's the overall feeling of this wine? That's where I start to get into matters of quality in the glass. There should be concentration, there should be richness, there should be depth. I mean, but the opposite could be true too. There's wines that are super easy drinking, super simple at heart. I mean, I would never take Beaujolais Village and look for those things in that glass because it's not meant to be there.
Yeah.
I guess that doesn't really answer the question.
Well, no, I mean, I think part of it is that my question was a little too overarching, because what you're looking for quality from Beaujolais Nouveau, which is often a perfect glass of wine for the occasion, when that's the occasion, versus if you're going to have a single vineyard Brunello, it's going to be different.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's really more about the context. All right, the question was semi good. I'll give this.
No, but you know what? To your point, and this is something that I tell staff when I'm training them: what separates good wine from great wine is concentration. It's like turning the volume up, and you can't recognize great wine until you've tasted really bad wine.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just start with Domaine de la Romanée-Conti's Romanée-Conti and say, oh, now I understand everything about wine and nothing will ever compare. Probably everyone's first glass of Grand Cru Burgundy sucks because it doesn't have what they're looking for. There's depth.
By the way, it's one thing so true. When I was younger, before I got into wine, before the bug hit me, and we'll get in how it got you, I remember declaring once, I don't like French wine. Like, I just remember just doing a general sweeping statement. I want to go back to the advance for a second. Do you remember any of the questions they asked you for theory? The main reason I ask is I always have to give people to understand just how difficult it is and how much you have to learn and know, because sometimes they're going to ask you some messed up question that maybe something you didn't study. So do you remember any of your questions?
Oh yeah, I remember a ton of them. I mean, I remember a lot of the ones that I struggled with for sure. So a really simple question that it didn't stump me. I knew the range, but I'm positive that I got it wrong, was what's the residual sugar level, what's the maximum residual sugar level for Pouilly Fumé? So that's going into the cahier des charges for the appellation and looking. It's a dry wine appellation, so we know that it's not going to be more than 4 grams of sugar per liter, Pouilly Fumé, based on Sauvignon Blanc. Well, how dry is dry? So the options in my head were 2 grams, 3 grams, 4 grams, because those are all your dry wine appellations. The answer is 3 grams per liter, by the way. I wrote 4 grams. So officially I got that wrong. But it's a simple question that represents a really specific place, and it's wine law. But if you start to put all of the appellations side by side in France, all of the dry wine appellations, which is 90% of them, I would say, they're all gonna be in that range. And there's a gentleman, I think his last name is Ord. He wrote a little docket about studying for the Master Sommelier theory. He said, listen, if all of the dry wine appellations are 4 grams per liter, just ask which ones are different and why. So if you put that in your head, everything across France is 4 grams per liter until they go sweet, then you say, okay, why is Pouilly Fumé 3 grams?
Right.
Why is a different area 2 grams per liter? But it's maybe an easier way to kind of take them all in rather than rote memorization of going, okay, Sancerre, Pouilly Fumé 3 grams. Pouilly Fumé, 4 grams. Doesn't really get you anywhere. You're just kind of throwing darts at a dartboard.
And that's harder to do than if you put in context and you ask bigger picture questions, which actually is just more fascinating and stimulating to the mind. And if it's fascinating, it's going to stick there. What did you open when you found out you passed? You had to have opened up something nice.
No.
What?
I got together with a few sommeliers there, three of us actually, and we had maybe 7 bottles of wine that night.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The last one, probably the least memorable,
hopefully
to be sure.
Hopefully it wasn't something nice. Hopefully you ended with Beaujolais Nouveau.
I think it was a Côte du Rhône.
Okay.
You know, something
perfect.
Simple,
perfect.
Easy drinking.
Yes.
The most prestigious in that lineup was a bottle of Dönhoff Riesling from the Naya.
Nice.
But truly, there was nothing special in that lineup. It was just, we all needed a glass of wine, and we finished with 7 bottles.
well deserved, by the way.
But when we came back, eventually, once the elation came down, and I could sit with, oh, yes, I've passed this thing, I've got this pin, I've got this, you know, certificate, nobody can take that away from me. Then I started to open a couple of nice bottles of wine. There was some white Burgundy in there. There was some older Bordeaux. Nothing off the charts.
Yeah.
I mean, every day's special in sommeliers' lives, I think.
Yeah, that's fair. I remember when I did the W-set, when I got the diploma, Old Bottle of Telegraph is what I opened.
Yeah.
By the way, I remember I got the envelope when I was in the elevator with going to my condo surrounded by other people. I'm like, I need to look at this before I see my girlfriend, because if I failed, I need a second or two to emotionally reset myself.
Sure.
So I actually opened it, found out I'd passed diploma in an elevator with strangers.
Yeah.
And I just quietly celebrated inwardly before I got into my condo.
Yeah, there's, you know, we all put a lot of pressure on those things, on those moments, and who knows how any of us will react until we do it.
Yeah.
There's so much preparation you can do for that moment. When I passed the advanced exam down south, I was the first one to be walked into the space with two master sommeliers who said, okay, Jeffrey, come with us. They walked me to the very end of this banquet hall, and the walk was terrifying. I mean, absolutely terrifying. I had no idea what they were going to say or anything else. I felt good, but I was in the dark. And then they sat me down. They said, okay, first off, congratulations. I said, yeah, thank you. You know, I've had a really good time being here and so on. And they're like, no, congratulations, you passed. I was just like, oh, holy shit.
Now, did you freak out? Did you swear? Or did you go, thank you very much?
No, I got pretty emotional. And I was like, okay, yep, thank you. Yeah, okay. And then they said, oh, okay, was the long walk worth it? And I was like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
No, you had me terrified. Yeah. Why would you do that to someone?
What a bunch of assholes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But it was a nice feeling, for sure. It was certainly a surprise, overwhelming emotion present. And I said to them, I was like, I wasn't sure if I would cry if I passed or if I failed. Well, apparently I'll cry if I pass. So. Yeah. Yeah, here we are.
You know what? Happy tears are better than sad tears.
100%.
Before we get into the CAPS challenge, I always like to have these interviews bounce around, so just going back and forth, which, you know, that might not be the best approach, but here we are. We are at Blue Bovine, and another thing we were just talking about before is that this place, and again, I wish I got paid by Blue Bovine for what I'm going to talk about. Me, I just love I love both the restaurant and the private wine club as someone who loves wine.
Yeah.
And loves wine culture. So I love what you guys do. I love, and we'll talk about, again, your happy hour. I love that commitment. But this place here, the Private Wine Club, is great because, as you said, you don't need to put your 50-year-old bottles of first growth Bordeaux. This is a place to leave 30 really good wines that you want either after work or before a Leaf game or Raptors or something.
Yeah, 100%. This isn't the place where somebody's going to start building their greatest collection of the greatest hits of wine.
They're not going to leave their child's birth year wine here.
That's right. You can't. There's not enough space. You can't. This isn't the place to store 20 cases of DRC or Lafite or anything like that. The point of this space is to have really easy access, and it's at this great commuter hub, Union Station. You can grab this as you're going anywhere in Toronto. You want wines that are ready to drink in these lockers here. You want wines that you can pull out any day of the week. Maybe they're special or whatever. And to your point, if they're great 30-year-old first growths, those are probably in their prime drinking window, so it can actually be a great thing to keep in a space like this, standing upright so you don't have to think about the sediment as you're opening those things up. But this is, it's built for quick access. It's built for the social aspect of drinking, which to me is the most important point of drinking. I mean, sitting in the dark and drinking old Chateau Lanerse by myself, not really that enjoyable. It's enjoyable for the first couple minutes intellectually, and then after that, it's just drinking.
It's, you know what, it's funny, that is so true. When girlfriend's flight attendant, so there is oftentimes I'm just on my own, and she always feels bad because I'm the one who buys all the wine. I'm like, well, that's what I spend my money on.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell her, the wine tastes better when I'm drinking it with you. And when I'm drinking a great bottle on my own, you're right. The first 15 minutes, you're always doing the assessing. You're always looking at the structure. But then on minute 22, you're just rewatching an episode of Breaking Bad while having a nice meal, drinking a glass of wine, and now you're just drinking a glass of wine.
That's right. It's just a fermented beverage at the end of the day. It's just alcohol in the glass. The great thing about it is how complex it is as a beverage. But when you're not sharing that with someone, sharing complexities with yourself in any aspect usually isn't that interesting.
And then the other side, though, to your point about the good thing about if you want to drink your 30-plus-year-old, if you want the 82 Latour, at least here the staff is going to know what to do with it. If there's a problem with the cork, they're going to know what to do with it. You're going to get the best stemware. Hell, there might be a candle involved when they're decanting it.
Yeah.
You never know. So at the very least, it's probably better for them to open the wine than a lot of people who don't know what they're doing opening that old bottle of wine.
That's right. We have not a complex tool set, but I guarantee you every sommelier in this company at least has access to either an Asso or a Durand for opening those old bottles. I think a lot of people also get scared when a cork breaks or anything else. They're like, oh no, what do I do? Now the wine's corked. Well, no, the cork has been in the bottle the whole time. It's just a question of how you extract it or what you do with the wine at that point. If you've got a ton of sediment and you're worried about it, put it through a bit of cheesecloth, put it through a filter, take that out. At the end of the day, sediment's not going to kill you, cork's not going to kill you. Nothing's going to, even volatile acidity or acetic acid is not going to kill you. There's nothing in wine that's inherently dangerous, except maybe when they added glycerol and ethanol in the 1980s, which actually did kill some people out of Piedmont. But we've got the tools to open old bottles of wine. Corks fail. They dry up. They get soaked. I mean, the most difficult thing to open, certainly in anybody's register, is going to be old bottles of port, because those corks are impossible, absolutely impossible to extract. And the best tool that not a lot of people have are port tongs. And it's maybe the coolest way to open a bottle of wine outside of sabering. Heating up the neck and cracking the...
That's right, yeah. But anyone listening, don't try to heat up the neck and break it off unless you've got at least training. Or at least watch a YouTube video and make sure you've got a bucket of water nearby.
Watch several YouTube videos. Yeah. I mean, it's not for the faint of heart. And it is dangerous. It is inherently dangerous. Those are very, very sharp things that you're introducing to your life.
Side topic, the wax on the top of wine bottles. I hate it. It looks nice, but it's a pain in the ass. As someone who's worked in the business, your thoughts on the wax?
So there's two different types of wax. I mean, this is not a technical thing, but there's really hard wax and there's really soft wax. I love dealing with the soft wax. I mean, there's a ton of producers that use it. And all you have to do is put your corkscrew through it. The hard wax that you have to fight with and hammer down. Like Vigna Tondonia, their Gran Reserva wines are always under that super hard wax. It's a mess. It's a mess to open up. I've heard there's certain strategies with hot towels. It starts to melt it a little bit. Haven't tried it. Maybe I should.
But also, if you're busy restaurant, the last thing, okay, everyone, heat some towels. Like
Exactly. I mean, of course, this is part of the preparation that we have to do as somms. You know, we bring bottles to the table that are ready to be presented and served. But it is. It's a pain in the ass to deal with, for sure. That hard wax that you're just hammering away at, making a mess, putting little bits of wax everywhere.
It's just unnecessary. It's like the super...
But from a technical place, I think I understand it. It adds this extra hermetic seal. And I honestly think, and I said this the other day to someone, because we use Corvin a lot to deal with some more high-end bottles. It's not a perfect system by any means. And every now and then, all of us somms, when we're getting together, we'll put something under Corvin that's been under Corvin and find, oh, it's completely oxidized because the cork has failed or whatever. I think the best way, but not the most economical, would be, once you use the Corvin, is to dip the neck and cork in wax again to give it that extra hermetic layer that you know, okay, there's no oxygen egression here.
The 2025 Caps Cup Tasting Challenge, congratulations.
Thank you.
How do you prep at all for these sorts of things, or is it just, you know, you've been in the industry long enough, you got your advance, you know what you're doing. Is there any prep that you do leading up?
The short answer is no. The long answer is yes. The work that we do as sommeliers in training and so on always involves blind tasting. But blind tasting is theory. Mm-hmm. Theory is always the most important thing. The further that we go, the deeper our understanding of theory is. But when you're prepping for something like that, it's really just reminding yourself of what the cursors are, what the markers are for certain styles and so on. And yes, I opened this Sancerre for the two of us, and Sancerre can be a really easy thing to recognize if you know what to look for, and it can be a really hard thing to recognize if you don't know what to look for, because Sancerre represents a neutral white grape. But what's really great, and this is a great example, Sancerre has two things that should stand out, or rather Sauvignon Blanc does. One is thiols and the other is pyrazines. And if you can find either one of those things in the glass, you're probably in a great place to recognize that it's Sauvignon Blanc. And then you walk it to, well, this is cooler, this is fresher, this is steely, this is mineral. That's what makes it Sancerre over, let's say, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. But I think this is a glass that's loaded with thiols. It has that grapefruity kind of grapefruit skin texture that tells you, okay, this is what's in the glass.
Yeah, there's a grapefruit that took me away for a second. I was thinking Chablis. I'm like, nope, I'm gonna stay with
That's Sancerre. It. Yeah. Sancerre is Chablis that tastes like Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, it's true. What are some of the coolest notes from the challenge? What were the paces they put you through?
Yeah, it was a difficult test and it was an easy test at the same time because I kind of thought about it in an Occam's razor kind of way. Whatever the simplest, most direct answer is correct. So the first wine, Ontario Chardonnay from Batch Elder, fantastic, fantastic producer, by the way. I have maybe an easier time recognizing Ontario Chardonnay because I've tasted so much of it and it's all delicious. We get acid for free in Ontario. And the second you recognize that, the second you're tasting something super delicious that has spent time in oak, that has the lactic textures of Chardonnay, but has crazy high acid, it's pretty simple to walk it into Ontario from there. Yeah, you can make the argument for Chablis. Chablis tends to have quite a bit of acid. I think Ontario has higher, leaner acid profiles. And there's a great example. I was tasting DeLoro wines recently, which also was the prize that I got for winning that challenge. The pH on that Chardonnay, 2023 DeLoro Chardonnay, is 2.9. Mm-hmm. Which is incredibly, incredibly low. That is a crazy, crazy amount of acid for wine. Most wine, for context, sits between 3.2 Riesling and 3.8, sometimes even over 4. So the second that you recognize that, you go, okay, where would this acid be coming from?
Right.
Ontario is a cool climate. We have very few growing degree days. There's no way around it. We are a cool climate. Even though we feel quite warm, the average temperature in the summer in Niagara is 28 degrees. That's great for slow ripening of grapes, but it means we're going to cultivate a ton of acidity in everything that we're producing.
I should have been asking you ages ago about how your journey, how you got into wine, but now I got to do one other sidetrack. Because of just the price of Burgundy and just economy in general. And at some point, I have to stop spending so much money on wine.
Sure.
I find I am very comfortable now where I buy almost no Burgundy. Certainly very little Burgundy, white Burgundy, just because of what Ontario gives us. Whether it is Batchelder or Kaylouse or... I mean,
sure.
I can go on and on. Westgate. There's so many... Westcott, excuse me.
Westcott. Sure.
There's so many great... That it's like, I don't have as much wine FOMO about not having as much white Burgundy. And it's not about the Burgundy. Burgundy's incredible.
Yeah.
But it's more about the price of Burgundy and also the consistent quality of Ontario.
Sure. Yeah, that didn't sound like a question.
Is
the question, should I be upset that I'm missing out on so much great Burgundy?
I guess the question is, do you believe that the wine buyer can get most of what they want from Chardonnay from Niagara and feel okay getting less white Burgundy?
Whew, that's a loaded question. That's tough to unpack.
Well, I went from no question to a really difficult question.
White Burgundy might be one of the greatest examples in the world of great white wine.
And I don't disagree.
Yeah.
To me, if you're going to look at the greatest white wines on planet Earth, it's white Burgundy and it's German Riesling, depending on the style you prefer. For me personally, that's where I'm going.
Sure. Yeah, those are two of the greatest examples, especially of terroir-driven wines, of wines of place. I mean, there's almost nothing that spells out where it's from, quite like great Chardonnay or great Riesling, and even better if you're walking it into the Moselle, or, you know, in the case of Burgundy, walking it into Burgundy. Can you get everything that you want in Ontario that's emblematic of great white Burgundy? No. Can you get a lot of what you want? Yes. And maybe my favorite example is the Hill of Wingfield Chardonnay from Thomas Batchelder. That might be the greatest example of white Burgundy-like Chardonnay in Ontario. I think it's just a stunning, stunning example for a fraction of the price. But if you put great Puligny-Montrachet in front of me and you put that Hill of Wingfield, I would be a little harder pressed to figure out which one is which. I think the use of oak is fantastic. I think the power, the weight of that wine is incredible. Yes, we make great Chardonnay in Ontario,
but we don't make white Burgundy.
No.
Oh, that's
no,
a stunning, stunning example. But I'll never give up Burgundy. I'll keep paying for it. I'll keep wanting it. I'll keep on hunting for it. But I will drink Chardonnay from Ontario in the meantime and be very happy with it.
Yeah.
Be very, very happy with it. I think, yeah.
It's a tough
amazing,
question.
Amazing
it's more examples. for people that maybe can't afford it. I always say, listen, if you can't afford the Burgundy, you're not going to go wrong with Niagara.
But listen, I mean, in terms of QPR, Niagara's fantastic, and you get some amazingly stunning examples. But we're a nascent industry.
Yeah.
You know, sure, our first plantings go back to the 1970s. Before that, we were doing non-Vitis vinifera, non-European grape varieties. But the reality is, it's not until the early 2000s that we really start to pick up great winemaking, great training, and so on. And now we're a wine industry in its teens.
Yeah,
we're starting to see amazing stuff. Yeah. And the 2020 vintage, I think, was a great driver for that because it was so, so good in Ontario. But we're nascent. We're young. We're still figuring ourselves out.
Oh, agreed. I remember, you know, when I was getting into wine, I was never a fan of so much Ontario wine just because, you know, as you said, the vines weren't old enough, and for so long we didn't focus on the right things.
A lot of it was bad. Yeah. 20 years ago, a lot of the wine that we were producing was bulk wine.
Mm-hmm.
It was overly sweetened. It was just to fill the need for something, not for great wine. Today, there's so much great wine being produced in Ontario. There's so much stuff that's so delicious. And again, the quality-price ratio is really, really good. I think we are missing a significant bracket of premium wine in Ontario. And I do think a lot of people are afraid to go there just because they don't know if the market will handle it well. But that's part of the next step of bringing more interest, more investment, and so on into our province as far as wine is concerned, is to build that premium tier of wines.
And also the psychology of getting people in Ontario, because wine's a very conservative thing, convincing someone to spend at the LCBO $100 or
sure.
$200.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, at a restaurant, then you're talking $200 or so.
Absolutely.
You know, just the psychological nature of that is going to be difficult.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go back to you. I blame you. There's been so, you know, the theater stuff, and then we just go off on all these different all these different tangents. How did you go from being interested? You were, you know, into food and stuff. Like, when did you decide, I'm going to focus my life? Because to go get your advanced, you have to sacrifice so much of a normal life to go and get that pin. When did you start to realize wine is the world I want to be in?
I mean, you know, let's be clear, Matt. It's not a sacrifice to focus all my time drinking great wine and eating great food.
Now
that has not been a burden.
That's fair, but you're also spending a lot of time studying yeah. soil, wine law, pH, you know, sugar levels, wind, mountains,
yeah,
rivers.
That's right.
There's all that stuff.
History, culture, language.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, to me, that's been the great joy of it all. I always liked studying something when I was growing up, and I never knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an actor for a long time because I thought, oh, this is a great way to explore a whole bunch of things. Like, I get to play doctor, I get to play lawyer, I get to play into all these things. And part of doing that was always, okay, I'm going to research this now. Look at the language, look at the culture, the idea of how does a lawyer stand, how does a lawyer speak, and so on. Well, the great thing about wine is it incorporates all these different aspects. It's geology, it's geography, it's history, it's culture, it's language, and so on, all wrapped up into one thing that's this really tasty beverage that I really enjoy from time to time. So when I started off in the industry, as I was finishing theater school, I was a busboy in a restaurant. Luckily, that restaurant had a really deep wine list. We had about 350 references there. That was La Société in Yorkville.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So part of my task on the daily was to go down and restock the cellar. And I kept looking at things like the 2003 Aubryon that was in the cellar for $5,000 compared to the Chateau du Trignon Gigondas that was $50, and asking, why in the world would somebody spend 100 times the value of this Gigondas to get this Aubryon? And I started talking with the sommelier there, and it opened a door that I just haven't been able to close since. So I continued in that pace, became a restaurant server, started to think about wine in a more serious way, started to ask questions about it, started to do a bit of research. It's a rabbit hole. I mean, there's no end to the amount of studying, training, and so on that you can do. You look at somebody like Clive Coates, who spent their whole life studying Burgundy, and they'll probably tell you they know nothing. He'll probably say, well, there's still a lot more to discover, because there's another 50 vintages ahead that he knows nothing about. And every single year, it's going back and going back and going back and retasting and retraining, asking who the new winemaker is, what they're doing, and so on. In 2018, I made the decision to be a sommelier. I made the decision to move into that part of the restaurant industry. And I made the decision then to become an advanced sommelier. And so that's what I've been training for since 2018. Then I passed, obviously, this past year in July. And the question was, what's next? Because now I have this pin that represents all of the studying that I've done, but I'm not stopping training. I'm not stopping traveling the world to drink great wine, to taste with great producers, and so on. So the logical question that a lot of people had was, well, when are you going to do Master Sommelier? And when I came back, I was really offended by that question. I was like, can't you just say, hey, great job.
Yeah.
You know, congratulations. Take a break. Enjoy yourself. Here's a great glass of wine. And now, just a few months later, I'm going, yeah, when am I taking the Master Sommelier Theory exam? So 2027 is in my sights.
Okay.
And I've got a curriculum written for it. And I've got some great peers that I'm going to start studying with. And yeah, it's...
How important are those peers? How important is the community around you to get that pin?
It's essential. It's essential. You cannot study in the dark. You can't know what you don't know until somebody tells you you don't know it. And I'm sure every single person who's gone through it, maybe with a few exceptions early on in the 1980s, will tell you the same thing. You have to study with other people. You have to ask questions. You have to spend the time talking about what you know and what you don't know around somebody else who knows what you don't know and what you know, and knows what they know and what they don't know, because that's how you expand your worldview. I mean, echo chambers aren't good. When you keep repeating the same thing to yourself, it waters down. It doesn't get to a greater point of understanding. I have so many people that I'm so grateful for being in my life and mentoring me along the way, because they help to refocus you along the way. They tell you things that, you know, you might get really stuck on what are the subregions of the Rias Baixas. And you're like, oh man, but how many hectoliters of wine are they producing in Val do Salnés? And somebody says, hey, stop, that's not important. It is important in the grand scheme of things, but it's not important to passing that exam. Just know that it's there. Just know that they're producing Albarino. Just know that it's a very wet part of Spain, very cool part of Spain. And then move on and really hone in on the things that are gonna be the most important, the most pressing in terms of studying. And that's the great thing about having peers and mentors around you is they help to refocus you every single day.
What is your role here? How would you describe your job here at Blue Bovine?
So I'm the head sommelier here. My job, first and foremost, is sell great wine to great people. It's to make sure that there's always stock on hand, but also it's to open up the door for training, for understanding of wine, because it's not just the somm's job to sell wine. It's everybody's job. We want to put things in the glass of every single person, but we want to put the things in those glasses that they want to drink. The way to do that is through understanding, is through building training and focus. To me, the most important thing that's often missing in wine training is talking about structure. Structure is the fundamental part of understanding wine at a complex level. At a basic level, it's places. Okay, here's Napa, here's Burgundy, and so on. But it's the structure underneath that makes us capable of selling those things. Because if somebody tells me, oh, I really like Burgundian Pinot Noir, I know they want something that's light to medium bodied.
Right.
I know they want something that typically has more acid, but I also know they want something that's maybe a bit more luxurious. And so unpacking all of those things can be really tough without the deep level of understanding. But at least if you understand that somebody's looking for something fresher and lighter, then we have a place to play.
Let's help people out there. People on a budget, we'll start there. Best areas to focus on. Who can, you know, they're going out for dinner and they're going to spend $100. somewhere between $100 and $150 for a bottle of wine. And, you know, there's markups and all that, and markups are important. That's what keeps restaurants open. That restaurants being open means that people have jobs and employment and you have somewhere to go. I am always, I've never an issue with markup, except for certain restaurants. I'm like, really? Five times on that bottle? What sure. are you doing?
Yeah.
But in terms of area to focus on, if someone's, you know, someone's a nice glass of red wine, nice bottle of red wine, $100 to $200.
You know, the great thing is there's never been a better time to drink cheap wine. Mm-hmm. The quality of wine across the world has never been better. I mean, I know there are people who reference the 1800s, the pre-phylloxera days, and saying those were maybe the greatest wines that ever existed, and we're missing ungrafted vines and so on. But the fact is the last 20 years has been about bringing the quality of the lowest tier of wine. The quality of the greatest wines on the planet hasn't really changed. Those wines are especially good today, but they've always been at a great level. And cleaning up the vineyards and focusing on better viticulture and so on has been, you know, a great thing. But you look at a place like Barolo. The Barolos are fantastic. They always have been. I mean, of course, there's some weird years like 91, 92, 93 that maybe it's really hard to find a great bottle from those vintages. But today, if you don't want to spend the price, if you don't want to spend the money on Barolo, drink Langhe Nebbiolo. It's fantastic. The quality is there. The vine age is there. Everything about it is incredible. Drink second labels of first growths. All of those wines are just stunning, stunning examples. You don't have to overspend in any region right now. I was just down in Napa for a week tasting with producers there, Napa and Sonoma. And a great example, I was tasting with the export director of Clos du Val. And Clos du Val, one of the great examples, part of the Judgment of Paris, 1976. Those wines can be prohibitively expensive, but they've got a new, just red wine. And that's how they label it. The fruit is sourced from Lodi. The fruit is sourced from Paso Robles. It's the same winemaking team. It's the same culture of viticulture and viniculture. But the price point is $15 compared to $150.
Right.
And that wine's fantastic. Does it have the same depth and concentration of the Hirondelle Estate wines? No. Is it delicious wine that I can absolutely enjoy without thinking about? 100%. Yeah, there's a ton of great places to look for value. I mean, if you like freshness, I love Picpoul de Pinay. In the south of France, I think those wines just absolutely kill for the price point. Rhone Valley Whites, stunning, stunning
love
examples.
Love Rhone Valley Whites. If you wanted something different from Chardonnay, go over to Rhone Valley Whites.
100%.
It's a great one. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's so much diversity there as well. I mean, you've got wines that are driven by Viognier and that have those peachy and lychee characters to them. But you've also got wines that are built from claret and they're so fresh and mineral and slightly herbaceous. And then you've got everything in between. You've got some Bourboulenc in there. You've got some Picpoul. There's so much to discover in so many different places. And I guess this is why I'll always tell you, talk to the sommelier if they're there. Because if you want value, we can find you value.
We'll end with this because this interview's gone on longer. And I'm sure you got a ton of things to do. Brag a little bit about the happy hour. I'm a huge fan of it. I've come a bunch of times. But brag about the happy hour at Blue Bovine.
Yeah, I mean, there's no better time to drink wine than between 3 and 6 in Blue Bovine when 90% of our list is half price. I mean, you just can't beat that. We're practically giving away the wine for free during those 3 hours. And there's so many great choices on that list. And the great thing that I get to do is keep buying wine to fill that list to make sure that people can come in and drink those wines for half price. There's no shortage of great wines in that list. And if you want to introduce yourself to a new style, that's a great time to do it with a little bit less risk. You know, you're not committing now $100. Instead, you're committing $50.
It's crazy.
To that bottle.
Oh, yeah.
You know, bring a couple friends, open a few things, and have a great time because we've got some great, great picks on that list.
Agreed. And yeah, shout out Liberty Entertainment Group between here, all the different restaurants. I've interviewed a bunch of the somms that have worked all of them. Like, I mean, you guys, the commitment to wine is one of the reasons I keep coming back to people related to it and keep coming back to Blue Bovine. But all that aside, Jeff, congratulations, man.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations on all the work and congratulations on the happy tears for getting the advanced somm. We will chat again. I wish you all the best for 2027. And really appreciate you doing the pate. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. It was a pleasure chatting with you, Matt.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.